And if anybody has any specific questions or insights about these while you're here, I'm very happy to address those. But and we still have these are the issues that we are still discussing and studying. As soon as we believe that we have come to a consensus for ourselves, we will, close off this work item for us. Sorry, you went too fast. And again, these are consistent with what we had reported before. There are certainly some issues with scale, and we are focused a lot on DNS resolution, making an observation that we want to, as that is one of the critical services in a registry functionality that has to be provided, we are particularly concerned about how registrants deal with that issue, because the information that's in their zone file is not necessarily readily accessible to them, and so there are separate issues there. In fact, we have in ESSEC, you'll be hearing later on, a presentation about zone risk. So we have actually spun off this particular topic, and so we'll say some things here in this report, but we have spun it off as a larger question of how to deal with zone risk for our registrant. And so we have a separate document we'll be producing, and there's a separate work party that you'll be hearing about after in a couple more presentations. So I just wanted to call that out. So our next steps is to prepare our final report. We did have a draft report, and we're now still incorporating comments and considering how we want to add them to our existing document. And, of course, it'll get a final review to the entire committee. And we are looking to have our final publication in time for the June ICANN meeting. That's our target at the moment. And we believe we're pretty close. So, but if anyone has any additional comments or questions, insights that you'd like to offer, we'd very much like to hear them. You can offer them up now, or please feel free to come up. I'm happy to talk to anyone afterwards if you want to tag me and part of the work party, and be very happy to listen to you and incorporate any comments that you have. Thank you.
Anyone have any additional questions or input? In that case, and let's move to the next. The next work party is about source address validation. And Marika Keo, please.
Good morning. My name is Marika Keo, and I'm leading the source address validation work party. Next slide, please. So this work came about as, we were discussing that maybe there should be more outreach and an understanding of whether or not source address validation is still an issue and what the current developments are. So, the working group is creating a new paper where basically it's discussing what actually is source address validation. So techniques to verify that source IP addresses of packets submitted to the Internet are valid, which means that they're not assigned from private address space and fall within a range of legitimately advertised prefixes for a given origin. The currently developed techniques and that are somewhat used are either Bogon filtering or URPF, unicast reverse path forwarding. Next slide, please. So why is this actually important? Well, there's a lot of spoof traffic that's used for malicious activities, such as denial of service attacks, spam campaigns, and also impersonation of originating hosts where the IP address is used as a form of authentication. Next slide, please. So there's a lot of prior work that's been done over the last decade, and these lists, most of them, IETF BCP 38, there's an ESSAC document that was created many years back, NIST, the US CERT Malware Threats and Mitigation Strategies, NSA Router Security Guide, SANS, ISA. Next slide, please. So the current ESSAC activity is to actually study existing prior work, and one thing that we've also identified is that there has to be more clarification in terms of terminology because ingress and egress are sometimes misused terms. We're also studying filtering by ISPs or edge networks, how much of that is done, and studying new developments in source address validation techniques, specifically things that are being done in the IETF, such as in the SAVI working group and RPKI. Also, we're trying to debunk some myths, because as we've talked to a lot of people who are or who are not using it, many of them have some historical issues in terms of buggy code or just things that weren't working properly. We're also studying the costs and benefits of a holistic approach, And the hope is to come up with a set of recommendations from a technical level as to what is valid in terms of source address validation. So that's it as an update. And if anybody has any comments, I would love to hear them.
This is interesting. This will be a very quick session. Okay, let's move over to the next item. Dave Piscatello on DNS zone risk analysis.
Thank you, Patrick, and good morning, everyone. I am the ICANN staff support for this project. Jim Galvin is actually the chairperson. We decided that we would share the presentation responsibilities today. So the subject is called DNS zone risk analysis, and the sort of background to this is twofold. The technical background that I'm going to present to you now is a relatively simple overview of how the DNS works, and in its most fundamental form, domain name resolution is based on what's called zone file data. And this refers to the records in a zone file or in a text file, more or less, that are called resource records. And the principal among these are usually the bindings between domain names and addresses and services. There are different kinds of name servers in the DNS, and the ones that host a zone file are called authoritative, whereas the ones that query the authoritative name servers are called recursive. And the purpose of having both of these is to allow a distributed system that enables people to acquire name resolution rather quickly and locally. Next, please. The issue comes in, where we're talking about risk is when the registrant has to go and identify and provide authoritative name service. And there are several different ways that registrants do this today. Either he hosts it himself, meaning he has a publicly addressable server that runs DNS that acts as the authority and hosts his own file. Or he engages some third party that he authorizes to host the zone file on his behalf. So for every domain name that you host, there has to be an authority. And in many cases, it's economically and more more productive for an organization to outsource hosting to either a company that specializes in DNS hosting or the registrar from whom he obtained the domain name registration, or a reseller who also offers DNS hosting as an additional service beyond registration. The registrant's internet service provider or access provider, even a web hosting provider or perhaps a managed service provider, in particular, someone like a brand online protection agency or some organization that's providing managed security services might be one that hosts the authoritative name service for an organization. Next, please. So the interesting problem comes in when we start to think about the ways that registrants actually compose and publish their zone file. And then obviously there's certain information that the registrant has to know, and there's also a lot of information that the registrant doesn't really actually have to know depending on who is doing the hosting for him. So in the case where the registrant himself is hosting, he has to compose the zone and publish it on his own host, and he has to pretty much know all the records that are going to comprise the master file. In the case where the registrant is outsourcing, there is usually some sort of exchange between the registrant that involves the composition and transmission of information between the registrant and the hosting provider so that a complete a zone file can be published. There are several scenarios here. And the two that I just described are scenarios where the registrant actually knows all the resources and the bindings. So in both cases here, the registrant's actually sending the hosting provider or publishing information that he has composed in its entirety. Next slide. that there are also circumstances where where third parties want to actually simplify and accommodate registrants who don't know a great deal about DNS and don't really want to know a great deal about DNS. And so in these cases, sometimes the registrant only has to provide some or perhaps almost no information to a DNS hosting provider. An example would be if you went to a registrar that provides both DNS service and registration service, and you also have that registrar host DNS for you, and you also have that registrar host web for you. A lot of this is automated, through a web portal, through a submission form, and the zone file is generated for you without ever knowing anything about the information that is used to compose it. So in these scenarios, the registrant not only may not know all the resources and bindings, but may have no real way to actually obtain them. And the problem definition derived from this is that the registrant who does not have complete knowledge of the information used to create a zone file for a domain is at risk of having name service interrupted without their ability to restore name service. So one scenario where this has occurred is a case where a registrar has gone out of business, and the registry was notified by the registrant that, hey, my name service isn't working, and the registry was attempting to help the customer in this particular case and discovered that the registrant had absolutely no understanding or knowledge of any of the information, didn't know where the name server was, didn't know what the IP address of the web server was, had no notion of DNS. And this was not just one customer, but many, many customers, or domain holders in the registry. So this is a pretty unsettling circumstance for anyone who is relying on continuous online presence. And there are a number of things that certain registrars do today to provide tools for registrants and that other DNS hosters provide. Next. I've sort of already touched on this. It's important that someone knows knows all this information, and that in the case of a name service interruption, there's a way to restore that information or to migrate that information over to a new provider. And the reason it's important is pretty clear. Name resolution is basically an essential and critical service on the internet. If you can't resolve the name, you can't get to the website. Most people don't use IP addresses. And so any circumstance where a name resolution is interrupted is a potential threat or risk to an organization, no matter how small. Next slide. So, we've talked about these being threats, and we've talked a little bit about at least one example of how this, how this materializes in the real world. But generally, the case is that a technical or business failure of any DNS hosting provider, not simply a registrar or a reseller, whether temporary or permanent, can result in the loss of the original data or the intended data for the authoritative name service. And the other threat landscape is account compromise, where there's an intentional misconfiguration results in the loss of the original data and no one actually has the full data to restore. The third is a case where it's an unintentional misconfiguration resulting in the same loss of data. Next, please. So the working group has identified sort of five overarching methods for mitigating this risk, and that the methods are not necessarily hosting provider specific or registrant specific, but there are actions that either party or both could take to reduce the risk of losing all the original data when a zone file or name service is interrupted. The first is pretty obvious. It's what I, living in South Carolina, call a hurricane box. You actually have to have documentation that you take with you when you leave the island, thinking you're going to go back and your house is gone. And so you document your DNS architecture, you document your operations, you document all the information that you need to actually reproduce the zone file that was published prior to any interruption, and you keep that document up to date. The second is to design for resiliency, have a situation where you have at least two name service providers, and you have that diversity that allows you to be resilient from the failure of one of either technical or business of one of your DNS hosting providers. The third is to actively manage your zone data, to keep track of it, to monitor it, as we say in SAC 44, to see if there are changes. The fourth is to implement appropriate defenses against such attacks. In particular, the kinds of attacks we're talking about here are the ones where you might have an account compromised. And again, we talk about these in SAC 44, and proactively monitoring your name service. We've touched on some of these things in SAC 44, which we published several months ago. But what we're going to try to do is focus specifically on this particular threat and ways to mitigate the risk in the document that we expect to produce prior to the next ICANN meeting. Next slide, please. So that's it. If you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. Is the mic on?
are people awake? This is really interesting. I think during my 5 years in SAC, I don't think I've encountered this before. Yes, please come to the table. Yes, we should have a present for you.
Gavin Brown from CentralNIC. I had a question about the zone risk stuff you just described, in that any company that outsources any of the technical parts of its online presence is basically at the mercy of the same sort of problems that you've already described, whether it's kind of cloud hosting of email or web hosting or whatever. If you don't keep backups of the stuff that you give other people, you're going to be at the same sort of risks. So how is the sort of good practice that people would put in place for their website content or their email any different from the good practice they put in place for their DNS?
So the question is, how is a DNS risk analysis and specification of mitigation techniques any different from the kinds of risk and mitigation practices you would have for any other service? And the answer is none. It's just that application is specific. And as we all know, people are supposed to practice archiving and supposed to be able to recover, and business continuity is something that you can find 10 million hits if you search. Yet every day there's someone who stumbles and falls because they don't know these things. And so this is just one more advisory and one more way to repetition is the key to learning, right? It's just so you have two ways to learn. You either you repeat the error and you learn you stumble and fall, and maybe you recover, or you can repeat it over and over again and you're a fool, or maybe you listen to some of the things that are published.
DNS is also one of those things that people don't really think about. I mean, they sort of think about their website and they think about email, but DNS is sort of infrastructure that just exists, and it just doesn't occur to them that this is something important.
And I just could remind people to identify yourself. The last person who spoke was Warren Kumari from the ESSEC.
I'm Gavin Brown from CentralNIC.
Was the person who asked the question.
And I absolutely agree that awareness is anything that raises the awareness of this is a good thing. I would say that from a kind of point of view of a registry that also has a small registrar function attached to it, that some people don't think about their website either. it's not like, I don't think there's that big a difference. I think if people back up their website from whoever hosts it, they probably also think about keeping an eye on the DNS as well. The number of people who we get calls from who have lost everything because as far as they were concerned, it was just somewhere in the cloud and they never needed to care about it.
There's going to be a whole series of clouds to help you do this, right? It's like, they're going to be business continuity clouds, all the rest of the clouds, and the whole world is getting more and more clouded every day. One of the things that I'd point out is there are a number of registrars that I've visited and looked at their user interfaces, and some do a stellar job of having a nice big button that says, download your DNS zone file. I mean, it's like it couldn't be more apparent, and I love that people actually pay attention to this and they have that level of detail. But you're absolutely right. Having a button that says download and archive your website right alongside that DNS button would be a wonderful, wonderful mechanism.
The only risk is, of course, is if no one...
Okay, please.
Yes, this is Bob Hutchinson. I'm curious, it seems like we're stuck in a model where the solution to registrant problems here at ICANN is that we tell them that they need to learn everything that we know, okay? And I'm wondering if you looked at alternate models, because my experience from small business on the web tells me that this is, you may as well, you know, you don't waste your time trying to document this, because the customers who are putting up websites who are, they know nothing about DNS. They will never know anything about DNS. This is a burden that should be placed upon the people who are running the DNS infrastructure, not registrants. And I'm, you know, that's just a different viewpoint of what you've done, and I wonder if you've really taken a serious look at doing it in another way.
Well, I guess I'd question what the other way would be besides policy, and more amendments, to contracts that would oblige registrars. And I guess in this particular circumstance, the problem space is much broader than just the registrar. And so the anyone who hosts DNS, as I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, could in fact be incented to or obliged to provide this kind of this kind of backup and service, and ICANN's reach is just not going to make it that far. So in many of the cases where ESSAC looks at an activity, our the perspective is very similar to the perspective of like the Anti-Phishing Working Group or the NCFTA. It's educate and inform and try to get people to have that same mentality of stop, look, connect, and try to understand that this is not a television. This is not just a unicast delivery device.
I guess I would counter that by saying that people who run networks have a higher bar of responsibility. It is not the telephone company's prerogative to tell you that in order for your telephone to work, you need to understand routing infrastructure within the telephone company.
I mean, we could have a debate over this, over beer. I mean, I sympathize with a lot of what you say. I've been doing education for consumer and small business for many, many years, I can only tell you that there's a limit to what you can push, and impose on, on people to offer voluntarily, unless there's an incentive for them to, and a business case for them to do so, because it provides a competitive advantage.
Yeah, I guess.
But we have a speaker list, and I need to be able to run that. So please wait until I tell you to speak, please.
Yeah, this is Russ Mundy. I'd like to just comment that I believe that if you think a little further about what you've just described, you're asking for the owner or holder or those that have some significant dependency on a name for other people to have complete and total control of it. That you are saying, if I understood what you said correctly, that you, as the holder or whomever it might be, do not want and should not have control. I think this is, in a way, the inverse of what we're trying to get at, is that people don't recognize that a name or a set of names is a very important resource for their business or activity or function. And without that name and without them taking responsibility at some level, then they will likely at some point in time have an event which will be devastating to their ability to do online activities.
So, thank you, Bob.
And everyone at the microphone, please say your name.
So I'm Jim Galvin. So thank you, Bob, for that question. And I want to observe that I think based on Chris's question over here, you know, that I think that Dave answered the question. I want to give a slightly different perspective on a way to answer that question. I think what's important here is that ESSAC does not itself create policy. So we provide recommendations, and we're really feeding two communities in this particular case. One community, of course, is the ICANN community itself and that policy development process. So one of the things that we will do in our recommendations is provide a specific recommendation for the GNSO community, for the registrar stakeholder group in particular, that they should look at and think about whether or not they want to create policies to support this activity and the need for registrants to be protected. And there may be other stakeholder groups that we will consider to provide direct recommendations to. But as part of that process, I think that we also serve a role in educating the Internet community at large and the ICANN community at large. And so, you know, we produce documents that have, we believe, you know, stand on their own merit and say a useful thing that we hope helps the community itself ask the right questions of specific service providers or specific activities that they're doing so that they can meet their own needs.
And then complete silence again. This is really interesting. Anyone else on this topic?
Yes.
Paul.
A lot of the authority DNS providers.
What's your name, Paul?
He already identified me.
This is Paul Vixie speaking. From the ESSAC. Thanks.
Thank you. A lot of authority DNS providers, the outsourced providers that were mentioned in these slides, don't use zones internally. They don't have zones. Some of them, in order to create something that would be like a zone, would have to execute a completely synthetic operation because they normally answer from a piece of code which generates answers dynamically. I know, for example, that the CDN providers all do this. Of course, the CDN providers are, in that case, not outsourced authority providers. But nevertheless, the advice that that we might give, where we said you as a registrant probably ought to have a copy of the data that's being generated for you, will in some cases fall on completely non sequitur ears because there is no data being generated for you. So I just want to sort of note that in passing. I like zone files, but some people do not.
I was nodding. This is Dave Piscatello. First time I've actually identified myself in 30 minutes, but I think that's a really good point, and that it's certainly something we should, you know, we should indicate. At the very least, what the registrant probably needs to know if he has, if he can get, is the bindings of names to addresses that are most critical for sustaining service in the case of an interruption so that he could, you know, migrate or quickly rehost. So.
I'm just thinking about the overall issue here.
And your name is?
Oh, I'm sorry. Damn it. Rod Rasmussen with Internet Identity. Thinking about this issue from a different perspective, it's really a recovery issue, right, where things have been lost. There is, I think, a solution that will largely allow people to recover, which is being able to perhaps watch DNS resolution and track it over time, which is being done through things like passive DNS, where you could reconstruct the zone post-event, there's various implementations of that, and I think there's various people who might be able to provide that kind of service. The question is that a viable economic model for the people who are going to lose those kinds of domain delegations, or if they're not paying attention in the first place, are they even going to be able to aware of such a service? And you could provide such a service in a kind of a public utility format, but then who pays for that and how?
I don't think so. This is a little bit like saying...
And your name
Mark
is?
Mark Seiden, sorry, from the ESSAC. It's a little bit like saying there are forensic disk recovery services that will grub through your disk at very high cost, just in case you don't take backups. I think we should encourage people to have copies of their data, even if they don't understand what it means.
Is there anyone on the remote that would like to say anything? In that case, I would like to go to the next topic about ESSAC improvement and outcomes. And I hand over to Steve Crocker.
Thank you very much. Yes, I am Steve Crocker for the record here. Thank you. So this is a review of the ESSAC improvements process. The background is that the bylaws for ICANN have a mechanism built in that requires a formal review of every portion of ICANN, sort of component by component, on a periodic basis. So ICANN is now, 12 years old? And this version of the bylaws come from around 2003, I think, 2002. Thank you, Vonda. The process is a very lengthy and slow-moving process that involves formulating a working group that reports to the board, and then formulating terms of reference for what the review process is going to look like, searching for an outside contractor to carry out a review, engaging that group, having them, then they do their work, and then they produce a report. There's a public comment period. Then there's an internal absorption and consideration, and the board working group that is overseeing all of this makes some recommendations, and eventually it comes up through the board for final approval. In that lengthy sequence, my recollection is that the GNSO was the first group that was selected to be put through that process, and maybe ALAC is the second one. Vonda, does that seem reasonable?
Please use the microphone.
No. It's no.
And your name is?
Vanda from Brazil. And the first one was GNSO, yeah? And then the second one was the ALAC.
ALAC,
started,
yeah.
And then the ESSAC.
Well, I don't remember precisely, but my recollection is that when the schedule was laid out, ESSAC was in the middle of the pack. That we weren't near the beginning and we weren't near the end, and RSAC was next to us. And all of this is on the record somewhere, easy to find. So with that as background, here is the schedule that is specific to the review of ESSAC. So a couple of years ago, the board appointed the review working group, and then, let's see. No, we have to go back. Not included in here is the external review process, right?
This is Julie Hedlund. Yeah, there are a few steps before that. This was shortened a little bit just to, bring us to the most recent activities.
Right. Apologies here for not having sort of thought through the presentation here carefully. Well, anyway, these are the major steps. In the middle there, where it says ESSAC published operational procedures, this is a sort of separate activity that we initiated entirely internally and not really tied to the review process, just tied to the fact that ESSAC had been advancing step by step from its original informal beginnings back in 2002. And over a period of time, gradually getting more formal and more organized about its processes. When we started, we were all volunteer operation. We had no staff support whatsoever. Over a period of time, we developed a cadre of very, very competent and energetic staff support people. We began to formalize the way in which we produced reports and so forth. Somewhere along the line, I don't remember precisely when, I began to be concerned in my role as chair that we should have we should write down what it was we were doing, not so much to create a body of law in a sense, but just memory of the way we do things, so that if other people were going to get involved, they could do the same thing. One of the things that I found myself focusing on is that we named that collection of procedures very carefully operational procedures, and avoided using the word policy in order to make sure that we were not confusing anybody, that we're creating absolute rules or anything. So there's, and there's a tendency to write things down that people take that as immutable or as formally charged, but this was really more just a collection of memory. But in the process of doing that, it fit nicely with the review processes and some of the issues that were raised in the review related to transparency and predictability. And so that so it is appropriate to mention it here, but it really came from a kind of more natural internal process. So that brings us up toward the middle of last year, where the board working group looked at both the external review report from JAS, and we conducted our own internal examination of the critiques from the outside and various issues, and made our own set of recommendations. So now we're in the very last stages of this, of trying to finalize the improvements and the implementation plan. Next slide, please. One interesting thing to look at is the workload that we've taken on is embodied in a number of reports. This is a selection of the reports, not all of them. We number from one upward, and there may be one or two holes in there, but this goes up to SAC 45, and there's far fewer than 45 reports listed on there. These are the ones that resulted in specific board resolutions. Now, again, this is a maturation process. As a matter of form, the board reports to the board, SAC reports to the board, gives advice to the board. We've generally prepared reports, published them, formally submitted them to the board, been a little inconsistent about whether the board has formally accepted them and formally passed any resolutions, but gradually trying to tighten all that up, including, from a purely procedural point of view, doing the following two things. Within our reports, being specific about what recommendations we're making, and then in forwarding these reports to the board, asking the board to take specific actions. So when Peter Dengate Thrush became chairman of the board a couple of years ago, I recall that one of the reactions he had as we submitted the next report is, so please tell us precisely what you want us to do so that we can be effective at doing it, because the board is a very thin operation. It can't it's not operational. It can't do anything very much. It has to pass things along either down to the staff of ICANN to take action, or out to the supporting organizations and other advisory committees. So here's a set of, just as a matter of record, of the ones that have reported that resulted in specific resolutions, although many of the resolutions are of the form, thank you very much, or we take note of what you've said. There was one specific area where the board was more forceful, and that had to do with the redirection, with the problems that came up quite forcefully in 2003 with SiteFinder. The board has been very strongly supportive of trying to help quell the use of redirection of wildcards in top-level domains. Now, as I think everybody knows, ICANN has two very different kinds of relationships with top-level domain operators. There are the contracted ones, the so-called generic top-level domains that operate under contract with ICANN. And there's room to put strong language in the contracts. For the ccTLDs, they operate in with a great deal more autonomy. And ICANN does not have contractual force to apply, but it has quite a lot of bully pulpit authority, if you will, where it can give strong advice and sort of set the stage. So those are the kind of things that the board has, in fact, done in that particular area based largely on advice that we've given, although there's inputs from other areas. Next slide. Oh, we're done. We're not quite done. A level of detail that is not here but which is important and which there's actually been developments within the past day or so. I'm actually mildly uncertain as to precisely where we stand. So I'll give my picture of things and then ask Patrick and perhaps others to chime in. In the charter for SSAC, which is embodied in the bylaws of ICANN, the first bullet of that charter talks about SSAC creating a security framework. In my tenure, we took a couple of swipes at trying to do that without great success. During the review process, the reviewers noted quite properly that when they looked at our charter and we looked at what we'd actually done, that we fell short in that area. We responded by saying, yep, in essence, you're right, and we rather than simply feeling bad about it and saying we'll try to work harder, perhaps the right thing to do is to examine whether or not SSAC is really the right body to do that sort of thing, whether we're constructed properly and have the right purview. And we recommended removing that part of our charter, removing that bullet. And that was accepted by the board working group and moved along up to the now here's a bit of inside baseball. Within the board, there are a number of board committees. One of them is called the Structural Improvements Committee. Ray Polzak heads that, and until recently, Ray was also vice chair of SSAC, so communication between SSAC and the Structural Improvements Committee was quite good. And so as a matter of form, the Structural Improvements Committee then prepared a resolution for the board saying that the charter, the bylaws were going to be changed in specifically by removing that bullet from our charter. A bylaws change for ICANN is a heavyweight operation. It's not done casually and it's not done quickly. So even if the board passes that there's a that's the beginning of a process that involves public comment and some time delays and so forth. This ran, the timing of this, which was a couple months ago, ran directly into a lot of focus of attention on the relatively recent affirmation of commitments process that ICANN has been engaged with over the past year or so, couple years. And one of the requirements in the affirmation of commitments process is that every board action be analyzed with respect to its impact on security and stability. There's some other aspects to it. It's not the only one, but that's certainly the one, one of them, and relevant for this conversation. So it caused a pause in the deliberation, saying, well, what position is ICANN in if it simply removes this bullet from the bylaws for in the charter for SSAC, and there is no analysis of what its impact is and no replacement of it and so forth? And so there was been some strong back and forth inside ICANN staff and inside the board to figure out what to do. Last I knew, the agreement was to transfer that responsibility to the CEO and through the CEO to the ICANN staff. Within the last 48 hours, I think there's been yet further consideration. And now I'm going to, I think I know the rest of the story, but I think Patrick is in a better position to fill in these details.
Thank you very much, Steve. Patrick Feldstrom, chair of ESSAC. Actually, I'm not. Because this is something that is our liaison to the board, Ram, is not in the room, and so I thank you for the description, but I cannot really fill you in add much data here. So I think you actually have later data.
Let me. I think it's unfair to leave the audience here just hanging, and at the same time, you and I are in complementary positions of being at two ends of a not very long chain, but with two critical people not present. Ram Mohan is the liaison to the board from ESSAC, and Ray Polzak is still chair of the Structural Improvements Committee, also on the board. Patrick, I have the impression, I apologize for doing this sort of unrehearsed out here in public, but I have the impression that you were re-examining that aspect of the ESSAC charter and suggesting that ESSAC might now be in a position to usefully contribute that sort of framework. And perhaps you can comment on that, and then we can tease that apart from the Structural Improvements Committee action.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. You're absolutely right. I can describe a little bit from ESSAC perspective what we have been doing. After you now describe what's happening on sort of your side, let me describe what has happened on our side since Cartagena. What we have done in ESSAC is that we went back and we re-examined our position, and we tried to look at what the actual issues we might see with the first bullet in our charter. And we saw basically two different issues. The first one, we thought that the bullet in the charter was something that is extremely broad. And there were even voices that said that, well, wait a second, that broad thing is probably not even in ICANN purview. It's like talk about security and stability of the internet and DNS on the planet Earth and like 5011 other planets or something, extremely broad. So to feel comfortable actually being able to work under some kind of because it is actually the charter for ESSAC, we felt that we needed to have some kind of clarity there. And remember that clarification doesn't have to imply that we're asking to do sort of fewer things or more things or anything, just that the charter must be clear so everyone agree on and understands what we are supposed to work with. Otherwise, we will absolutely end up in a position that when ESSAC is delivering something, there might be some parties that say, no, you have actually done something outside of the charter, or vice versa. So the first thing we would like to, we thought we what we have been working on actually is a clarification of the text, not change of the text from our perspective. But of course, other parties might have other views, because if people didn't have other views, the bullet would be clear, okay? The second thing we were looking at is that one of these items that is described as deliverables is something that we in ESSAC feel that we as a group of volunteers are incapable of doing. That is something that we would require support and financial support, and it's probably a report that actually has to be, someone has to pay and finance, and then ESSAC could sort of give the task to this group to have that written. So one of the big deliverables in the first bullet is something that we think is an explicit report that cannot be delivered by volunteers. Now, the reason why I first backed off and said I don't really know where we are is that this sort of result of this discussion that we have had in ESSAC is something that we sent back to SIC to sort of try to and then let SIC draw a conclusion over the sort of these two different inputs, And just because we are so close to a board meeting and we have our liaison to the board, that is one of the I just checked with Jim and I haven't talked with them since yesterday morning. So I don't want to, and I don't even know exactly where it is. So because of that, I'm really, really sorry that I cannot really bring you up to date on where we are. But now you sort of have all the inputs just like others. Thank you.
So I think maybe this is the this is as much as we can say. The two positive things here. There's a tremendous amount of attention and good intention, goodwill, and really just a question of sorting out how best to proceed and be effective here, matching up the charters and responsibilities with what the actual capabilities and resources are. And the main takeaway, however satisfying or unsatisfying it might be, is that your leadership team is hard at work here and trying to resolve this rapidly. The other element, which I actually feel very, very positive about, is that these review processes that I described at length at the beginning are lengthy and ponderous, and the peculiar fact, if you will, is that none of them, not a single one, has actually reached full cycle and completion. We are actually the farthest along, even though we started in the middle of the pack. And this is the single item that is blocking from 100% completion and closure of review process. So I keep hoping that ESSAC will be first over the line, although if we slow down enough, maybe somebody else will catch up with us. But that's where we are in the overall process. Certainly there's a very strong desire to have something resolved on this by Friday when the board meets and starts passing formal resolutions. And so one way or another, we're going to figure out whether this will or won't be on the agenda for the board to pass a resolution, and if not, then we know where we are, and if it is, we surely will know where we are. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions, and or anybody wants to chime in with other comments.
Thank you very much, Steve. Anyone that would like to ask anything or give an input? Please. Speak into your microphone, say your name. I'm sorry.
This is Bob Hutchinson again. I was wondering, I don't have a comment about what you just mentioned, Steve. I had a comment for Jim Gavlin on the registry transition work that was being done. I was wondering under what scenarios your work is designed to... is it under all scenarios? Did you consider more than financial failure within a registry? What scenarios of registry failures did you consider?
So this is Jim Galvin. The answer to your question is focusing on the five critical functions, and there are in the existing ICANN proposed procedures some SLAs that go with those functions. And so we are considering those, and we do have some comments about some of that. There's actually a separate ongoing work with respect to registry SLAs in ICANN. I like to think that we at least, had provided some motivation since we started having some comments and asked questions about those things. So it's more than just a financial failover. There are some actual SLA requirements that if you trip them, then it is intended to invoke different parts of the registry failover process.
Thank you.
Please.
Ben Wilson. I'm a newcomer, so I hope my comments are well received. It seems to me that, like any enterprise, it's hard to identify the return on investment of security, And I think what happens is that ICANN, like any other organization, has the business drives and the economic drives to keep costs down and not rock the boat. And I'm just wondering, it seems that if you have a group of security professionals that make recommendations or commentary on things, that the weight that those go to the board for ultimate decision should be given a higher priority or higher weight, or at least some recognition. And over time, and I'm not sure on the slide where it showed all of the different resolutions or recommendations, where that was exhibited in the history of what's gone on. And so I'm interested in knowing whether there are things that I don't understand about how ICANN works, or whether there are things that are underway to make sure that, and maybe that's what this whole discussion is about, to make sure that the voice or the input of this group gets sufficient attention within or on equal treatment as the other constituency groups within ICANN. And that's just my comment.
So let me comment in two ways. This is Jim Galvin, and I'll comment on two things. First, you know, ESSAC is not a policymaking body, so we just provide advice. And our goal has been, from the very beginning, for as long as ESSAC has existed, to provide, you know, technically sound, credible, valid advice. And, you know, our ultimate goal here is that we be objective, so we're not going to influence either way necessarily what the right thing to do is. Except in cases where we have a technical foundation or a technical basis to say that, you know, this is something you shouldn't do, or this is something that you should do if you want to achieve the, you know, the best operation from that perspective. So we create documents in general, and we have always strived to create documents that stand on their own, stand there, they're credible and reasonable, and the community will receive them in that light. That's a somewhat unique position from most of the groups in ICANN, because, you know, they are driven by a community of people who, in some form or another, have a particular goal in mind or a particular vested interest, and we try to stay out of that space in particular. So that's one part of the answer. Our documents stand on their own merit. The other part of the answer is, as part of the structural improvement that has gone on, one of the things that ESSAC has gotten to is we've also been formalizing our document publication procedures internally, as well as our interactions with the board. As Steve said, you know, there are some gaps there in the numbering. Part of that is, you know, we've just been evolving to a place where we're getting more formal about how we do our document publication process. And so, as a way of getting more engagement from other groups in ICANN who we believe should look at our documents and, you know, consider them and look at the advice and perhaps take them on board as something that they should look at as a work item, we do have specific recommendations. Our documents have taken on a formalized look, so we now have findings that go with them as well as specific recommendations. We break out recommendations into categories as to who they're really directed to, and a place that we are moving to, and it's evolving. It's not perfect yet, but we're going to you know, continue to improve that process, is to, before a document is finally published, we want to engage with these other groups, and if there are particular recommendations directed at particular parties, other groups within ICANN, we want to make sure they have an opportunity to see it, comment on it in advance, call it to their attention. And then as part of the final publication, in addition to submitting documents to the board, and then as Steve said, we had a specific request to make sure that when we submit documents to the board that we actually tell them if there are actions we want them to take. So we provided as advice because there was an issue that we felt we needed to speak on, and then we will call out to the board in particular if there are recommendations or actions that they need to take, and we'll do the same thing with the other groups. We will point out to them and highlight for them recommendations and such that belong to them and try to move that process along so that more of the community actually notices when we've done something which is relevant to them and then hopefully can take some action appropriate to the recommendation that we offer.
Thank you. I'm Mike Rodenbaugh. That was very interesting, Jim. Thank you. I'm very curious. I haven't seen protocols, if you will, about how the documents are going to be published, but the way you described it really concerns me as a generally representative of non-contracting parties with the realization that the vast majority of SAC recommendations are going to be directed towards contracting parties who are essentially going to have a chance to see the recommendations that SAC makes in advance, it didn't sound to me like those were going to go to the entire community. And so it seems to me like they would have the opportunity to kill or water those things down sort of in a quiet fashion with the SAC before the rest of the community got to see it. So I don't know if you'd like care to comment on that or not. I very well could be entirely wrong.
No, I'll offer two responses. Try and put the right spin on this because I don't want to say something really bad. Again, SAC creates advice and documents with a very firm technical foundation and in an objective way. So that means we will say what we believe is the right thing to say. Now, having said that, so that's just one thing. The other piece of that is making the documents visible and giving more people the opportunity to comment on them. I mean, we're always interested in other insight and other comments. But because, our documents are simply there and they exist and stand on their own, ideally we will speak to all of the issues that are raised by anyone in the community. So if you have a question or comment, we should say something about that in a document as part of our process. We need to take those comments on board and speak to an issue. But we get to respond or not respond in the way that we believe is appropriate and most effective for the document. With respect to non-contracting parties, actually, I guess I can say honestly, maybe Julie might have something else to say. I don't think you're actually on our list of people to make sure that we reach out to when we need to. And in that context, I thank you for that comment, and we'll certainly take that on board as part of looking at our document publication process. Do you want to add anything, Julie?
Yeah, this is Julie Headland, and thanks for that comment, Mike. Actually, our procedures, and you can find them linked directly from the main page of our website, and I welcome you to look at those. They're fairly voluminous, so it'll be a nice read for you sometime when you want to fall asleep some night. But what I will say, and you'll see in those procedures, is that when the work parties are developing a work product, one of the things that they will do is consider all of the various parties who may be affected by that advice. That could be contracted parties, it could be non-contracted parties, and it could be registrars, registrants, average users, whomever. And a piece that, as Jim mentioned, we have included in the procedures is that outreach to anyone we think that might be affected and to be able to get their input on the document while it's still at the development stage. And then, as Jim says, these are, again, purely technical documents. We'll take into consideration those comments and move ahead as the SAC sees appropriate, but we do certainly appreciate and seek that input. So I would ask that you take a look at our procedures, and if you think that there's something, a step in there that you think we need to include to make sure that all parties are considered, we'd certainly be welcoming your input. Thanks.
Thanks, both of you. Yeah, no, I would just point out that, any recommendation that would be implemented by contracting parties, of course, by extension, has implications to non-contracting parties. So really everybody should have an equal chance to comment on everything, in my view, as a general rule. So thanks.
If I might, this is Steve Greiner. You've heard multiple times the phrase SAC does not make policy. Let me translate that into operational terms. But I recognize that there's kind of what the formal and then what, how the things actually work. As a matter of form, what the output from ESSAC is at most a set of recommendations, and those cannot translate into any forceful action or contract changes or requirements by themselves. They have to be adopted by somebody else, by the board, by the supporting organizations, by other parties and so forth. So there is a very clear demarcation and division of labor in which the output from ESSAC is then input to something else. And at that point, the processes of those other groups become the ones that are appropriate. And so there's public comment periods. If they're going to adopt regulations or, you know, turn this into something forceful, that's what happens. So that's the form. That said, there's a I think a degree of recognition that, for better or for worse, over a period of time, as ESSAC has developed its pattern of developing reports and making recommendations, that those recommendations have been accepted as having a degree of stature, I'll say, if not authority. And so that puts us in ESSAC in the peculiar position of having a kind of success where we speak and people actually pay attention to it. So that's good. And on the other hand, it carries with it the burden of trying to be extra careful and not getting caught into the position that just because we said something, therefore everybody has to follow it. So there is a little bit of discrepancy between the formal process that says, you know, others are responsible for the adoption process versus a sort of leading edge effect of when we say something that it tends to have some effect. And that's a healthy, I mean, that's good. If nobody were paying attention to what we said, that would be worse, right? There's some recognition. We had tried, as Julie had said, to build into our procedures specific outreach during the production process and during a pre-publication process to alert people to what we are likely to be saying so that if they're likely to be affected, they know, and to do fact-checking and to get input back into it. It's not ever going to be a 100% perfect process. Improvements that can be made, I think, would be at least be interested in hearing about it. So it's an evolving process. And it's not my problem anymore, right? I'm just giving you the backward look.
Paul Jekfeldstrom, Chair of ESSAC, thank you for pointing that out. Seriously, I would like to very explicitly also thank Steve for everything he has done and the way he handed over things to me. He is actually still answering questions that I have very quickly, so thank you for the support, Steve. Anything else from anyone? While you are thinking about that and while you are rushing to the table, lining up by the microphones, remind you all that we have a session tomorrow about DNSSEC between 8:30 and 1:45, and that is in the Alexandra room on 32nd floor, and I hope to see many of you there. And that is something that might have, maybe I should have mentioned that from the beginning, because of course many of you thought that we should talk a lot about DNSSEC at this session, but we have a separate session on DNSSEC that we are running here at ESSAC. Rick?
Patrick and Steve, I just wanted to, my name's Rick Weston, I'm a member of the ESSAC, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to point out that I really appreciate how the constituency, I mean this committee, handled the transition. I thought it was an excellent an excellent moment in our existence. That, you know, 7 years of Steve's work and the transition to you and Jim, I just thought it was done really well, and I appreciate your both of your service.
And Ram too.
Anyone remotely that would like to say something?
Rick, I'll send you your check shortly. Thank you.
In that case, thank you everyone for coming. And I'm closing the session and giving the ability for you to be a little bit ahead in the queues at the lunch places around here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. This meeting of the ESSAC is adjourned.